The foregoing considerations are by no means an exhaustive account of the spiritual and cultural legacy of fiat inflation, but they should suffice to substantiate the main point, that fiat inflation is a powerhouse of social, economic, cultural, and spiritual destruction.
The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible.
What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we have got a fantastic little read today, which I actually just stumbled upon. I'll talk about it in just a second. Quick thank you to Swan Bitcoin and CoinKite for supporting this show. CoinKite are the makers of the Tap Signer, the Open Dime, the Cold Card hardware wallet, and the Cold Card Q1. I mean, just such an amazing set of hardware security devices, and then just fun stuff like the Block Lock. Don't forget that you can get a discount with my code Bitcoin Audible, so check them out. And of course, Swan, the Bitcoin only company to buy Bitcoin, to plug your entire life into Bitcoin. If you want to be on a Bitcoin standard, Swan has just about every tool that you need. Check them both out at the links available in the show notes. So I was actually just kind of going through stuff, trying to organize is quite the liberal word for what I'm having to do with my basement / studio / pile of crap that I've got down here. But I was going through some stuff and I just found a little booklet that I think is from BitBlock Boom, but I cannot remember for sure. And it's something that I think I actually read in the hotel when I first got it, and it's great. It's a Guido Holzmann piece, who is an Austrian economist, and you know, with the Mises Institute and everything. And this is a little Mises booklet, and it is a piece called "How Inflation Destroys Society." And I was literally just kind of like, in my brainstorming mode, and I just like sat down and I started reading like the first two pages of it, and then I read through all 20. Very quickly. It's a 20 page little booklet, and it is just phenomenal. And there are so many things. It's so hard to articulate the nuance and the second and third order effects of inflation and how the systemic fraud of counterfeiting money poisons so many levels of what we do, what we value, how we interact, and how we communicate. And I feel like this does such a good job of kind of laying the big pieces out and why it's a whole hell of a lot worse than just, oh yeah, it puts prices out of whack. So I don't want to precede the argument too much, because Holzmann does a wonderful job in this piece. So with that, we will save this for a guy's take after, and probably also a follow-up, because just this topic just deserves that level of attention, I feel like. So with that, let's go ahead and get into today's read, and it's titled "How Inflation Destroys Civilization," written by Herg Guido Holzmann. The notion that inflation is harmful is a staple of economic science, but most textbooks underrate the extent of the harm, because they define inflation much too narrowly as a lasting decrease of the purchasing power of money, or PPM, and also because they pay scant attention to the concrete forms of inflation. To appreciate the disruptive nature of inflation in its full extent, we must keep in mind that it springs from a violation of the fundamental rules of society. Inflation is what happens when people increase the money supply by fraud, imposition, and breach of contract. Invariably, it produces three characteristic consequences. 1, it benefits the perpetrators at the expense of all other money users. 2, it allows the accumulation of debt beyond the levels debts could reach on the free market. And 3, it reduces the purchasing power of money, or PPM, below the level it would have reached on the free market. While these three consequences are bad enough, things get much worse once inflation is encouraged and promoted by the state, fiat inflation. The government's fiat makes inflation perennial, and as a result, we observe the formation of inflation-specific institutions and habits. Thus, fiat inflation leaves a characteristic cultural and spiritual stain on human society. In what follows, we will take a closer look at some aspects of this legacy. 1. Hyper-centralized government. Inflation benefits the government that controls it, not only at the expense of the population at large, but also at the expense of all secondary and tertiary governments. It is a well-known fact that the European kings, during the rise of their nation-states in the 17th and 18th centuries, crushed the major vestiges of intermediate power. The democratic nation-states of the 19th and 20th centuries completed the centralization of power that had been begun under the kings. The economic driving force of this process was inflation, which at that point was entirely in the hands of the central state apparatus. More than any other economic reason, it made the nation-state irresistible, and thus it contributed, indirectly at least, to the popularity of nationalistic ideologies, which in the 20th century ushered in a frenetic worshipping of the nation-state. Inflation spurs the growth of central governments. It allows these governments to grow larger than they could become in a free society, and it allows them to monopolize governmental functions to an extent that would not occur under a natural production of money. This comes at the expense of all forms of intermediate government, and of course at the expense of civil society at large. The inflation-sponsored centralization of power turns the average citizen more and more into an isolated social atom. All of his social bonds are controlled by the central state, which also provides most of the services that formerly were provided by other social entities, such as family and local government. At the same time, the central direction of the state apparatus is removed from the daily life of its protégés. 2. Fiat inflation and war. Among the most gruesome consequences of fiat money, and of paper money in particular, is its ability to extend the length of wars. The destructions of war have the healthy effect of cooling down initial war frenzies. The more protracted and destructive a war becomes, therefore, the less is the population inclined to support it financially through taxes and the purchase of public bonds. Fiat inflation allows the government to ignore the fiscal resistance of its citizens and to maintain the war effort on its present level, or even to increase that level. The government just prints the notes it needs to buy cannons and boots. This is exactly what happened in the two world wars of the 20th century, at least in the case of the European states. The governments of France, Germany, Italy, Russia, and the United Kingdom covered a large part of their expenses through inflation. It is, of course, difficult to evaluate any precise quantitative impact, but it is not unreasonable to assume that fiat inflation prolonged both wars by many months or even 1 or 2 years. If we consider that the killings have reached their climax toward the end of the war, we must assume that many millions of lives could have been saved. Many people believe that in war, all means are just. In their eyes, fiat inflation is legitimate as a means to fend off lethal threats from a nation. But this argument is rather defective. It is not the case that all means are just in a war. There is in Catholic theology a theory of just war which stresses exactly this point. Fiat inflation would certainly be illegitimate if less offensive means were available to attain the same end. And fact is that such means exist and have always been at the disposition of governments, for example, credit money and additional taxation. Another typical line of defense of fiat money in wartime is that the government might know better than the citizens just how close victory is at hand. The ignorant population grows weary of the war and tends to resist additional taxation. But the government is perfectly acquainted with the situation. Without fiat money, its hands would be tied, with potentially disastrous consequences. The inflation just gives it the little extra something needed to win. It is, of course, conceivable that the government is better informed than its citizens, but it is difficult to see why this should be an obstacle in war finance. The most essential task of political leadership is to rally the masses behind its cause. Why should it be impossible for a government to spread its better information, thus convincing the populace of the need for additional taxes? This brings us to the following consideration. 3. Inflation and tyranny. War is just the most extreme case in which fiat inflation allows governments to pursue their goals without genuine support from their citizens. The printing press allows the government to tap the property of its people without having obtained their consent, and in fact, against their consent. What kind of government is it that arbitrarily takes the property of its citizens? Aristotle and many other political philosophers have called it tyranny. And monetary theorists from Mesmer to Mises have pointed out that fiat inflation, considered as a tool of government finance, is the characteristic financial technique of tyranny. 4. Race to the bottom in monetary organization. As Austrian economists have argued in some detail, fiat inflation is an inherently unstable way of producing money because it turns moral hazard and irresponsibility into an institution. The result is frequently recurring economic crises. Past efforts to repair these unwelcome effects, yet without questioning the principle of fiat inflation per se, have entailed a peculiar evolution of monetary institutions, some sort of an institutional, quote, race to the bottom. Important milestones of this process were fractional reserve banking, national central banking, international central banking, and finally, paper money. The devolution of monetary institutions has been on its way for centuries, and it has still not quite reached the absolute bottom, even though the process has accelerated very considerably in our age of paper money. 5. Business under fiat inflation. Fiat inflation has a profound impact on corporate finance. It makes liabilities, or credits, cheaper than they would be on a free market. This prompts entrepreneurs to finance their ventures to a greater extent than others through credits, rather than through equity, the capital brought into the firm by its owners. In a natural system of money production, banks would grant credit only as financial intermediaries. That is, they could lend out only those sums of money that they had either saved themselves or which other people had saved and then lent to the banks. The bankers would, of course, be free to grant credits under any terms, interest, securities, duration, that they like, but it would be suicidal for them to offer better terms than those that their own creditors had granted them. For example, if a bank receives a credit at 5%, it would be suicidal for it to lend this money at 4%. It follows that on a free market, profitable banking is constrained within fairly narrow limits, which in turn is determined by the savers. It is not possible for a bank to stay in business and to offer better terms than the savers who are most ready to part with their money for some time. But fractional reserve banks can do precisely that. Since they can produce additional banknotes at virtually zero cost, they can grant credit at rates that are lower than the rates that would otherwise have prevailed. And the beneficiaries will therefore finance some ventures through debts that they would otherwise have financed with their own money, or which they would not have started at all. Paper money has very much the same effect, but in a far greater dimension. A paper money producer can grant credits to virtually any extent and at virtually any terms. In the past few years, the Bank of Japan has offered credits at 0% interest, and it right now proceeds in some cases to actually pay people for taking its credits. It is obvious that few firms can afford to resist such offers. Competition is fierce in most industries, and the firms must seek to use the best terms available, lest they lose that, quote, competitive edge that can be decisive for profits and also for mere survival. It follows that fiat inflation makes business more dependent on banks than they otherwise would be. It creates greater hierarchy and central decision-making power than would exist on the free market. The entrepreneur who operates with 10% equity and 90% debts is not really an entrepreneur anymore. His creditors, usually bankers, are the true entrepreneurs who make all essential decisions. He is just a more or less well-paid executive, a manager. Thus, fiat inflation reduces the number of true entrepreneurs, independent men who operate with their own money. Such men still exist in astonishing numbers, but they can only survive because their superior talents match the inferior financial terms with which they have to cope. They must be more innovative and/or work harder than their competitors. They know the price of independence, and they are ready to pay it. Usually, they are more attached to the family business and care more for their employees than any anonymous banker. Because credits springing from fiat inflation provide an easy financial edge, they have the tendency to encourage reckless behavior by the chief executives. This is especially the case with managers of large corporations who have easy access to the capital markets. Their recklessness is often confused with innovativeness. The economist Joseph Schumpeter has famously characterized fractional reserve banking as some sort of a mainspring of innovative economic development because it provides additional money for entrepreneurs with great ideas. It is conceivable that in some cases it played this role, but the odds are overwhelmingly on the other side. As a general rule, any new product and any thoroughgoing innovation in business organization is a threat for banks because they are already more or less heavily invested in established companies, which produce the old products and use the old forms of organization. They have therefore every incentive to either prevent the innovation by declining to finance it or to communicate the new ideas to their partners in the business world. Thus, fractional reserve banking makes business more conservative than it otherwise would be. It benefits the established firms at the expense of innovative newcomers. Innovation is much more likely to come from independent businessmen, especially if income taxation is low. 6. The debt yoke. Some of the foregoing considerations also apply outside of the business world. Fiat inflation provides easy credits not only to governments and firms, but also to private persons. The mere fact that such credits are offered at all incites some people to go into debt who would otherwise have chosen not to do so. But easy credits become nearly irresistible in connection with another typical consequence of inflation, namely, the constantly rising price level. Whereas in former times the increase in prices has been barely noticeable, in our day, all citizens of the Western world are aware of the phenomenon. In countries such as Turkey or Brazil, where prices increase at annual rates of 80 to 100%, even younger people have personally experienced it. Such conditions impose a heavy penalty on cash savings. In the old days, savings was typically done in the form of hoarding gold and silver coins. It is true that such hoards did not provide any revenue. The metal was, quote, barren, and that they therefore did not lend themselves to the lifestyle of rentiers. But in all other respects, money hoards were a reliable and effective form of saving. Their purchasing power did not just evaporate in a few decades, and in times of economic growth, they even gained some purchasing power. Most importantly, they were extremely suitable for ordinary people. Carpenters, masons, tailors, and farmers are usually not very astute observers of the international capital markets. Putting some gold coins under their pillow or into a safe deposit box saved them lots of sleepless nights, and it made them independent of financial intermediaries. Now compare this old-time scenario with our present situation. The contrast could not be starker. It would be completely pointless in our day to hoard dollar or euro notes to prepare for retirement. A man in his 30s who plans to retire 30 years from today, 2004, must calculate with a depreciating factor on the order of 3. That is, he needs to save $3 today to have the purchasing power of 1 of these present-day dollars when he retires. And the estimated depreciation factor of 3 is rather on the low side. It follows that the rational saving strategy for him is to go into debt in order to buy assets the price of which will increase with inflation. This is exactly what happens today in most Western countries. As soon as young people have a job and thus a halfway stable source of revenue, they take on credit to buy a house, whereas their great-grandfather might still have first accumulated savings for some 30 years and then bought his house in cash. Needless to say that the latter has always been the Christian way. In St. Paul's letter to the Romans, we read, "Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for the one who loves another has fulfilled the law." Things are not much better for those who have already accumulated some wealth. It is true that inflation does not force them into debt, but in any case, it deprives them of the possibility of holding their savings in cash. Old people with a pension fund, widows, and the wardens of orphans must invest their money into the financial markets, lest its purchasing power evaporate under their noses. Thus, they become dependent on intermediaries and on the vagaries of stock and bond pricing. It is clear that this state of affairs is very beneficial for those who derive their living from the financial markets: stockbrokers, bond dealers, banks, mortgage corporations, and other, quote, players, have reason to be thankful for the constant decline of money's purchasing power under fiat inflation. But is this state of affairs also beneficial for the average citizen? In a certain sense, his debts and increased investment in the financial markets are beneficial for him given our present inflationary regime. When the increase of the price level is perennial, private debt is for him the best available strategy. But this means, of course, that without government interventionism into the monetary system, other strategies would be superior. The presence of central banks and paper money make debt-based financial strategies more attractive than strategies based on prior savings. It is not an exaggeration to say that through their monetary policy, Western governments have pushed their citizens into a state of financial dependency unknown to any previous generation. Already in 1931, Pius XI said, "It is obvious that not only is wealth concentrated in our times, but an immense power and despotic economic dictatorship is consolidated in the hands of a few, who often are not owners, but only the trustees and managing directors of invested funds, which they administer according to their own arbitrary will and pleasure. This dictatorship is being mostly forcibly exercised by those who, since they hold the money and completely control it, control credit also and rule the lending of money. Hence they regulate the flow, so to speak, of the life blood whereby the entire economic system lives, and have so firmly in their grasp the soul, as it were, of economic life that no one can breathe against their will." One wonders what vocabulary Pius XI would have used to describe our present situation. The usual justification for this state of affairs is that it allegedly stimulates industrial development. The money hoards of former times were not only sterile, they were actually harmful from an economic point of view, because they deprived business of the means of payments they needed for investments. The role of inflation is to provide these means. However, money hoarding does not have any negative macroeconomic implications. It does definitely not stifle industrial investments. Hoarding increases the purchasing power of money, and thus gives greater weight to the money units that remain in circulation. All goods and services can be bought, and all feasible investments can be made with these remaining units. The fundamental fact is that inflation does not bring into existence any additional resource. It merely changes the allocation of the existing resources. They no longer go to companies that are run by entrepreneurs who operate with their own money, but to business executives who run companies financed with bank credits. The net effect of the recent surge in household debt is therefore to throw entire populations into financial dependency. The moral implications are clear. Towering debts are incompatible with financial self-reliance, and thus they tend to weaken self-reliance also in all other spheres. The debt-ridden individual eventually adopts the habit of turning to others for help, rather than maturing into an economic and moral anchor for his family and of his wider community. Wishful thinking and submissiveness replaces soberness and independent judgment. And what about the many cases in which families can no longer shoulder the debt load? Then the result is either despair or, on the contrary, scorn for all standards of financial sanity. 7. Some spiritual casualties of fiat inflation. Fiat inflation constantly reduces the purchasing power of money. To some extent, it is possible for people to protect their savings against this trend, but this requires thorough financial knowledge, the time to constantly supervise one's investments, and a good dose of luck. People who lack one of these ingredients are likely to lose a substantial part of their assets. The savings of a lifetime often vanish in thin air during the last few years spent in retirement. The consequence is despair and the eradication of moral and social standards. But it would be wrong to infer that inflation produces this effect mainly among the elderly, as one writer observed. These effects are especially strong among the youth. They learn to live in the present and scorn those who try to teach them old-fashioned morality and thrift. Inflation thereby encourages mentality of immediate gratification that is plainly at variance with the discipline and eternal perspective required to exercise principles of biblical stewardship, such as long-term investment for the benefit of future generations. Even those citizens who are blessed with knowledge, time, and luck to protect the substance of their savings cannot evade inflation's harmful impact, because they have to adopt habits that are at odds with moral and spiritual health. Inflation forces them to spend much more time thinking about their money than they otherwise would. We have noticed already that the old way for ordinary citizens to make savings was the accumulation of cash. Under fiat inflation, this strategy is suicidal. They must invest into assets the value of which grows during the inflation. The most practical way to do this is to buy stocks and bonds, but this entails many hours spent on comparing and selecting appropriate titles, and it compels them to be ever watchful and concerned about their money for the rest of their lives. They need to follow the financial news and monitor the price quotations on the financial markets. Similarly, people will tend to prolong the phase of their life in which they strive to earn money, and they will place relatively greater emphasis on monetary returns than on any other criterion for choosing their profession. For example, some of those who would rather be inclined to gardening will nevertheless seek an industrial employment because the latter offers greater long-term monetary returns, and more people will accept employment far from home because it allows them to earn just a little extra money than under a natural monetary system. The spiritual dimension of these inflation-induced habits seems to be obvious. Money and financial questions come to play an exaggerated role in the life of man. Inflation makes society materialistic. More and more people strive for money income at the expense of personal happiness. Inflation-induced geographical mobility artificially weakens family bonds and patriotic loyalty. Many of those who tend to be greedy, envious, and niggardly anyway fall prey to sin. Even those who are not so inclined by their natures will be exposed to temptations they would not otherwise have felt. And because the vagaries of the financial markets also provide a ready excuse for an excessively parsimonious use of one's money, donations for charitable institutions will decline. Then there is the fact that perennial inflation tends to deteriorate product quality. Every seller knows that it is difficult to sell the same physical product at higher prices than in previous years, but increasing money prices are unavoidable when the money supply is subject to relentless growth. So what do sellers do? In many cases, the rescue comes through technological innovation, which allows for a cheaper production of the product, thus neutralizing or even overcompensating the countervailing influence of inflation. This is, for example, the case with personal computers and other equipment built with a large input of information technology. But in other industries, technological progress plays a much smaller role. Here, the sellers confront the above-mentioned problem. They then fabricate an inferior product and sell it under the same name, along with the euphemisms that have become customary in commercial marketing. For example, they might offer their customers light coffee and non-spicy vegetables, which translates into thin coffee and vegetables that have lost any trace of flavor. Similar product deterioration can be observed in the construction business. Countries plagued by perennial inflation seem to have a greater share of houses and streets that are in constant need of repair than other countries. In such an environment, people develop a more than sloppy attitude toward their language. If everything is what it is called, then it is difficult to explain the difference between truth and lie. Inflation tempts people to lie about their products, and perennial inflation encourages the habit of routine lies. The present writer has argued in other works that routine lies play a great role in fractional reserve banking, the basic institution of the fiat money system. Fiat inflation seems to spread this habit like a cancer over the rest of the economy. 8. Suffocating the flame. In most countries, the growth of the welfare state has been financed through the accumulation of public debt on a scale that would have been unthinkable without fiat inflation. A cursory glance at the historical record shows that the exponential growth of the welfare state, which in Europe started in the early 1970s, went in hand with the explosion of public debt. It is widely known that this development has been a major factor in the decline of the family, but it is commonly overlooked that the ultimate cause of this decline is fiat inflation. Perennial inflation slowly but assuredly destroys the family, thus suffocating the earthly flame of Christian morals. The Christian family is the most important, quote, producer of a certain type of morals. Family life is possible only if all members endorse norms, such as the legitimacy of authority, the heterosexual union between man and woman, and the prohibition of incest. And Christian families are based on additional norms, such as the love of the spouses for one another and for their offspring, the respect of children for their parents, the reality of the triune God, the truth of the Christian faith, etc. Parents constantly repeat, emphasize, and live these norms. This daily experience, quote, brainwashes all family members into accepting them as the normal state of affairs. In the wider social sphere, then, these persons act as advocates of the same norms in business associations, clubs, and politics. Friends and foes of the traditional Christian family agree on these facts. It is among other things because they recognize the family's effectiveness in establishing social norms that Christians seek to protect it. And it is precisely for the same reason that advocates of moral license seek to destroy it. The welfare state has been their preferred tool for the past 30 years. Today, the welfare state provides a great number of services that in former times were provided by families, and which we may assume will still be provided to a large extent by families if the welfare state ceased to exist. Education of the young, care for the elderly and sick, assistance in times of emergencies. All of these services were today effectively outsourced to the state. The families have been degraded into small production units that share utility bills, cars, refrigerators, and of course, the tax bill. The tax-financed welfare state then provides them with education and care. From an economic point of view, this arrangement is a pure waste of money. The fact is that the welfare state is inefficient. It provides comparatively lousy services at comparatively high costs. We need not dwell on the inability of government welfare agencies to provide the emotional and spiritual assistance that only springs from charity. Compassion cannot be bought. But the welfare state is also inefficient in purely economic terms. It operates through large bureaucracies and is therefore liable to lack incentives and economic criteria that would prevent the wasting of money. In the words of Pope John Paul II, "By intervening directly and depriving society of its responsibility, the social assistance state leads to a loss of human energies and an inordinate increase of public agencies, which are dominated more by bureaucratic ways of thinking than by concern for serving their clients, and which are accompanied by an enormous increase in spending. In fact, it would appear that needs are best understood and satisfied by people who are closest to them and who act as neighbors to those in need. It should be added that certain kinds of demands often call for a response which is not simply material, but which is capable of perceiving the deeper human need. Everyone knows this from first-hand experience, and a great number of scientific studies drive home the same point. It is precisely because the welfare state is an inefficient economic arrangement that it must rely on taxes. If the welfare state had to compete with families on equal terms, it could not stay in business for any length of time. It has driven the family and private charities out of the welfare market because people are forced to pay for it anyway. They are forced to pay taxes, and they cannot prevent the government from floating ever new loans which absorb the capital that otherwise would be used for the production of different goods and services. The excessive welfare state of our days is an all-out direct attack on the producers of Christian morals. But it weakens these morals also in indirect ways, most notably by subsidizing bad moral examples. The fact is that some alternative, quote, lifestyles carry great economic risks and therefore tend to be more expensive than the traditional family arrangements. The welfare state socializes the costs of such behavior and therefore gives it far greater prominence than it would have in a free society. Rather than carrying an economic penalty, public license might then actually go hand in hand with economic advantages because it dispenses the protagonist from the costs of family life, for example, the costs associated with raising children. With the backing of the welfare state, these protagonists may mock conservative morals as some sort of superstition that has no real-life impact. The spiritual dimension seems to be clear. The welfare state systematically exposes people to the temptation of believing that there are no time-tested moral precepts at all. Let us emphasize that the point of the preceding observations was not to attack welfare services, which are in fact an essential component of Christian societies. The point is rather that fiat inflation destroys the democratic control over the provision of these services, that this invariably leads to excessive growth of the aggregate welfare system and to excessive forms of welfare, and that this in turn is not without consequences for the moral and spiritual character of the population. The foregoing considerations are by no means an exhaustive account of the cultural and spiritual legacy of fiat inflation, but they should suffice to substantiate the main point: the fact that fiat inflation is a powerhouse of social, economic, cultural, and spiritual destruction. Someone I onboarded to Bitcoin very recently, just a few days ago, asked me if I trade Bitcoin. I don't, and I never will again, because I actually like my Bitcoin. That is why I auto stack with Swan Bitcoin and have done so for years. A simple automatic savings plan is the best way to get into Bitcoin, to just have an established Bitcoin position that you are constantly growing. And then whenever I have any fiat that isn't going out in bills, I can just smash buy whatever's left over in the Swan app because I am on a Bitcoin standard. And Swan Bitcoin is one of the best services for the entire suite of things that you would need to basically be on a full Bitcoin standard. Obviously, you can do an automatic and long-term savings plan. You can get your business and treasury set up with a Bitcoin balance, even a Bitcoin employee benefits package. You can set up an IRA in just a few minutes. If you have a business or a company that is allocating to your retirement, you can actually do that directly into Bitcoin. If you want a multi-sig vault where you use Swan as one of your keys that operates as a backup in the case that you lose one of your keys, you can now use their Swan Vault service. If you haven't explored Swan or you haven't checked them out or you haven't gotten into Bitcoin yet, they are the place to start. They are Bitcoin only. You're not going to be sold a bunch of crypto. You're not going to be told how to trade, and they don't take trading fees. That's not how they make their money. This is what those crypto exchanges don't tell you when they're pumping some other crypto token in front of you and saying you should buy some of this. What they want is for you to sell something else and buy that, and then sell that and buy something else constantly. Not because it's good for you, but because every single time you do, they make money. This is why you go with Bitcoin only. This is why you go with Swan Bitcoin. This is why you auto withdraw. This is why you go with a company that's going to teach you why you shouldn't do that and what the best strategy is. Check them out at swanbitcoin.com/guy. You know, it's funny. This was a really great piece. And I actually remember reading this. I mean, I don't actually remember where I was reading this, but I do remember reading this paper when I got it. And it was at one of the conferences. It might have been at BitBlock Boom. I can't remember for sure. But it's great because this was just absolutely full of gold. And there's actually so much I would love to unpack with this. In fact, this is largely the theme of the book I have 70 kind of random-ish pages of over, you know, the last 2 years. It's really just kind of about this idea. It's just kind of taking this in more depth and trying to enlighten why these things are so important, because it's so difficult to articulate the degree of impact that a lot of these things have, that we're talking about things that fundamentally alter how society works, how culture works, how we relate to each other. The society, the economic system, is a cultural and values-based system. It's a protocol by which we operate, we interoperate with each other so that we can actually come to consensus about the reality of things. And value is an insanely difficult reality to have some sort of consensus on, to draw information from, because it is subjective, because it is everyone's individual situation. And all of our economic calculation, all our ability and direction and goals and what we even perceive of as important or something to strive for is derived from that. When you fundamentally manipulate it, when you fundamentally screw with the mechanism by which we make that communication to begin with, you poison everything. Everything else is poisoned, because that's the entirety of the system. That's all it does. That is what our intersubjective reality is. It is our attempts to communicate that. If you mess with the communication tool, all of it changes. So when people complain about capitalism producing this, it's so unbelievably backwards, because none of this has anything to do with the free market. This is about a systemic form of fraud that is explicitly at odds with everything the free market is actually stands for, the reason we call something the free market to begin with. A free market presupposes sound money. You cannot have a free market without it. And I love this quote that's just straight from the beginning, because this is exactly what it means, is inflation is just what happens when people increase the money supply by fraud, imposition, and breach of contract. So a free market is when you voluntarily engage in any trade or contract. So I'm trading with you, and we voluntarily agree upon the exchange of value in that. And we have a metric by which we measure how to account for what that contract is worth. It's like, you know, you owe me 27 feet of 2x4. Like, that contract is based on the inches and feet necessary in order to enforce and measure what the contract is about. So a trade is a contract in value, which means it presupposes some sort of independent totem to measure what that value is. You can think of inflation, you can think of money printing, as a systemic external breach of contract. It is a way to undo every contract and undo the actual communication in every trade that we make through a third party, by someone who is not even party to the trade to begin with. The best way to put it is fraud, because it is enabling them to engage in the economy, to remove value and resources from the economy that they never put in. The whole point of the free market is that we voluntarily give up our resources. This is an involuntary breach of contract counterfeit means by which they can remove those resources and never put anything back. And it's important to understand that this is why so many of their metrics are also bullshit, because CPI is so stupid, and it's like trying to argue about GDP with people. Like GDP with sound money, like the stock market and the general stock market level would never go up, and GDP would not have to go up at all for there to be growth. In fact, GDP would largely just fluctuate around a certain level, the same with the stock market. But we have somehow equated the growth of GDP with the growth of the economy, but they have nothing to do with each other. GDP is a measure of activity measured in nominal units, which means it's entirely a product of how much money exists and how much we're moving it around, neither of which have any fundamental correlation to growth. There's no fundamental, like, existential connection to the reality of, like, things got better, the quality got better, and we got more innovative, and living standards increased with GDP. You can have GDP go down and actually have all of those things improve. And you can have GDP go up and all of those things get way, way worse. And CPI is largely the same way. In fact, it's really just... It's just a metricless way. It's a way without any totem to even compare it to. Attempt to measure the thing that money measures automatically when you just leave it alone. So the way to think about CPI is, how do you measure a house without a unit of measurement, without a foot or an inch? Like the very idea of the CPI on its face, it's like trying to measure in inches how many inches 20 inches changed by this year. So it's like 20 inches is now 2 inches longer than 20 inches was last year. It's like, so what is it? So it measures 22 inches? No, the inches are longer. So it measures 20 inches, but it changed by 2 inches. You can't measure something without a metric, without a unit. And sound money actually does that. Sound money is like the ground. It is a totem to compare things to, specifically so that we can communicate and make sense of what is happening in the economy and where things need to be allocated to actually do the most good, and specifically the most good according to the people on the ground in the situation, the values of the individuals. Not some shallow bullshit political values, not the values of some financial institution that's directing trillions and trillions of dollars that nobody ever gave to them, but the values of the actual people in society. So an analogy to understand just how ridiculous the CPI is like trying to measure how far a football was thrown without comparing it to the ground. Because you specifically, with the explicit intent to manipulate the game, you are literally defrauding where all the markers are on the ground. Like you're just changing the lines on the football field so that you can alter the outcome of the game. That's what the fraud of money manipulation and counterfeiting new currency units essentially does from an economic standpoint. It's like somebody can literally throw the ball only 3 feet and he just absolutely sucks, just miserable at playing football. But every single time he does, the government comes in and then shifts the lines so that it's actually 50 yards. But then the crazy thing is that our frame of reference is the ground. It is the measure of where we are and what's happening. So now suddenly we hailed this guy as the king of football. He's the one who gets all the sponsorships. He's the one who gets all the advertising contracts. And every kid who grows up wants to play football like him. Except that he is literal shit. He doesn't produce anything of value when it comes to the game of football. He exists entirely. His success exists entirely by playing the movement of the markers on the ground. So now that we have no way to actually measure how far anything was thrown, what we then do is decide to make up this stupidly convoluted bullshit metric called the DTI, the Distance Thrown Index. And what we do is we have hundreds of people running around this entire situation, and what they do is they mark down where all the people are sitting in the stadium. They make note of all the leaves that are on the ground. They make note of how fast the water is moving in the stream down the street. They mark where the clouds are in the sky. They geolocate every car in the parking lot. They gather as much possible spatial data of everything not connected to the ground in the area as they can possibly find. Then they use this basket of points in order to compare it to the ball and then say that on average, the ball has moved this amount. But then the wind blows a little bit, or it rains, or a game starts or stops, somebody leaves the parking lot, or a big event occurs, and all of it means jack shit. But here's the crazy thing. And remember, this is all just a giant convoluted apparatus that is done to recreate the very job done by one person who could just measure the distance on the f***ing ground. And this is where one of the really crazy things that I think is super underappreciated and people don't realize as a second and third order consequence of how awful this is and what the consequences of it are, there's a quote right here at the beginning that says, "The government's fiat makes inflation perennial, and as a result, we observe the formation of inflation-specific institutions and habits." It literally creates an entire industry, actually a series of industries, occupations, incomes, like all the entire systems, parts of the system, parts of the ecosystem of the economy that are built around taking advantage of, measuring, and making sense of this huge multi-trillion dollar breach of contract fraud. To put it simply as possible, when you have trillions of dollars worth of fraud every single year through the form of counterfeit, what you do, you don't just mess up those trillions of dollars. You mess up the entire balance of the economic system, so an industry builds up around that trillions of dollars that is more trillions of dollars that is manipulated, because rather than heading in the direction, like think about it, if there's somebody who is honest, there's three people, imagine the economy is three people, there's somebody who is honest and they have saved and they want to spend their money on a house made of brick because they want a house that is secure and solid and will last them for a long time. And then there is another person who is just doing marketing, and they want to market for brick houses because the guy who has the savings wants to make brick houses. Then there is another person who commits the fraud, who through the political system gets to just invent money out of thin air, and they don't really care about the quality of anything because it's not their money. They're just getting financed at impossible. I mean, they're just counterfeiting. They're just counterfeiting money. So what they do is they build three houses. They use up the resources and energy needed to make the brick house that the saver wants, and they make three plastic houses. But here's the thing. They have more capital to allocate, not because they were honest, not because they provided more value for society, but because they can extract more value from society because they've manipulated the metric by which we decide who actually created stuff. So the problem isn't just that the cheater gets the resources and the cheater gets to direct those resources instead of the saver, and the cheater's values are spread through society instead of the saver's values, but the marketer starts working for the cheater. So the marketer reinforces and amplifies everything about the cheater being the one who's wealthy, the cheater being the one who's successful, the cheater and the plastic house being the good house that everybody should buy. And the saver is the backwards, outdated values that nobody cares about anymore and aren't even successful. And there's no reason why the saver should be valued higher. There's no cultural differences or arbitrary. The cheater and the saver are completely equal. And this poison happens at every level of the society. Even children grow up looking at, you know, who's got the big house in the neighborhood? Who's the one that everybody listens to? Who are the people who are rewarded? This is why you have such a huge explosion of nihilism, because the actual values get separated from any economic meaning whatsoever. And I love one of the things that he points out in this. In fact, there's no way I can do this. I need to have an entire guy's take on this. One of the things that just I love and I think is so important to recognize is that, you know, people talk about like hoarding money as like people care about money or like is bad. And it's so funny that it's such a projection of the fiat system because it is explicitly the fiat system that forces everybody to think about money and to think about the markets and financing and debt and to stress over it and have it weigh on their soul day in and day out, where they are constantly just having to catch up and to put money at the center of their life always and forever. It is literally sound money that makes it easy, that makes it so you don't have to think about that. And you can actually care about the values of your life. You can actually think long-term about actually what you want to see in the world, what you actually want to build. Because the point isn't to get a big house. The point isn't to be the most important person. The point is for those values to actually align with what you want to see in the world, is to actually think long-term about what the consequences of what the hell we're doing here even are. And fiat inflation is a systemic fraud that makes it practically impossible on a long enough time scale and at a large enough scale of society to even do that calculation, to have that totem to even compare it to have the time and the energy to focus on that in our own lives. Because we are literally forced to do multiple jobs to fill in, to learn and focus on multiple things at multiple layers at a constant state of activity and a constant state of stress to do the one thing that money is supposed to do for free for us with no work at all is literally a poison on the fabric of society. So we're going to have a guy's take because I did not even get through the first page of this 20-page booklet. And honestly, if there was a theme of this show that wasn't explicitly about Bitcoin, it would be that fiat inflation destroys society. So let's do a deep dive on it. With that, we will wrap this one up. Thank you guys so much for listening. Do not forget to subscribe to the show. Don't forget to share this out with friends, family, the people you know who are trying to get into Bitcoin. That actually is a huge help. I've not really done any active marketing for this show ever, and it is all grown by word of mouth. So you guys are my growth. Thank you guys so much for supporting the show, for leaving me a review on Apple and Google Podcasts and Audible, all those good things. Don't forget to check out Fountain and leave me a boost. In fact, I meant to read some of those boosts today. I've got some really great ones, but I will save that for the next guy's take we have coming up. Lastly, a shout out to CoinKite and Swan Bitcoin for supporting this show. I would not be able to do this without them, and I wouldn't be able to do it without you guys. So thank you all so much, and I will catch you on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. Until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. Don't pay attention to, quote, authorities. Think for yourself. Richard P. Feynman.